All right, it is 1:50 PM, Wednesday, October 23rd. This is the in-person interview of Liberty Leadership Academy. The board and technical review panel appreciate that you have come today. We understand that the application process requires time, effort, and intensive commitment, and we wish to thank you for your interest in providing quality educational choices to the children of Arizona. The purpose of this interview is for the applicant to demonstrate how well it understands and has thought through the plan presented in the written application. The interview panel will use the responses to the questions to evaluate the capacity of the applicant to successfully implement the plan as outlined in the application. We will start with the introduction of the interview panel.
Hello, I'm Lynn Marsh. I'm the Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Arizona Board of Regents and was previously the Executive Director of the State Board for Charters.
And I'm Carrie Larson. I'm the Executive Director of School Improvement at ASU Prep.
Good. Okay. I'm Kyla Reed. I'm currently the Board of Directors for Reed Traditional Schools, but over the last 25 years I have worked with charter schools both in Arizona and at a national level in all areas of applications and grant writing, etc.
And also present is Rachel Hanna, who's the Assistant Director of Charter Support and Accountability at the State Board for Charter Schools. I will now go over the details of today's interview. This interview will last 90 minutes. The procedures and ground rules for the interview process are as follows. You will be given 5 minutes for introductions and to make your opening statement. I will cue you when you have 1 minute remaining and when the 5 minutes is complete. Expect to spend 2 to 3 minutes on the initial response to each question, allowing time for any follow-up questions made by the interview panel, and feel free to ask for any clarification. In order to give you the opportunity to respond to all of our questions, during the response to an individual question, the TRP team lead may ask you to move on and give you the opportunity to address any other responses in your closing statement. When 10 minutes remain in the interview period, you'll be asked to make a closing statement of no more than 5 minutes. We will conclude the interview with a description of the next steps. Do you have any questions about the procedure or ground rules for this interview? I will now turn things over to the TRP team lead who will be running the interview from here.
Thank you. Could you please start out by introducing yourselves, your team, include what role each member played in the application process, as well as what role each member intends to have in when the charter is approved, if the charter is approved, then follow with your opening statement.
My name is Rachel Dubian, and this is our team, our founding team. I've been an educator most of my life, both in public and charter schools. I quite enjoyed my time in charter schools. I've worked in Phoenix, California, and as well as Cottonwood, Arizona, which is where I live now. For the past 7 years, I was at a very small charter school, similar to the plan that we proposed. I grew up in Phoenix in a performing arts background at a dance studio, along with my two sisters, who also attended an art school for their middle school through high school. I attended public school, and we've seen the benefits of the arts and education. One of the reasons that we wanted to propose this school is because we've noticed the limitations of the arts in our area, and also just the lack of school choice. It's a very small community, and so there aren't a lot of schools that parents and students have options to, and there is definitely a desire. I've been a teacher, mostly third grade, elementary school, but also an aide, and worked in lots of different scenarios. I've seen the benefits of the arts in my own classroom, incorporating song and dance and visual arts and performing arts, and just seeing students who were typically low students or students who maybe weren't so interested in school really find that love of learning. And that's one of the benefits that I really want to increase in our area. My role in school as it opens will be the principal / director. And as far as the application process, we wrote the application together. I focused mainly on the education areas, and then, of course, coordinated with the business and the operations as well. This is my founding team, and I'll let them introduce themselves.
I'm Mary Miller, And I'm primarily responsible for the business side of the application and probably the business side of the continuing role of going through with the opening of the school. I have a background in finance. I've been a commercial lender for Chase Bank and Citibank. I've been a senior accountant for the General Accounting Office of Arizona, and I'm currently the budget manager for the Department of Public Safety, disengaging myself from that role to move over into the charter role. I had two daughters who went to ASA, same two that she was talking about, so you can make the connection. And they thrived at ASA, and they thrived in their college careers and in their business careers. And that has been a big impact in my decision to help Rachel with the starting of this school.
I'm Robin Kreutzberg, and I'm not related to either of these two. I have been an adult teacher, a teacher of adults. I have been a banker. I've been a lawyer. I've been an editor. My role in preparing the application was to write most of the B section, but I also wrote big chunks of the other sections as well, and I edited the whole thing at many different points along the way. My role as the school gets open will be to continue as the board president for the governing board for as long as that seems useful, and to just watch it take off and change the education landscape in Cottonwood.
Thank you. All right, we're just gonna jump right into the application questions, is that all right?
Definitely.
So in the revision of the application, you mentioned this, that you changed the terminology from arts integrated to arts enhanced. If you could just describe a little bit what motivated the change and how the perspective on the program has or has not changed throughout that process.
Definitely. I think the perspective has not changed too much. The change in vocabulary is more in our additional education and learning what those mean. Originally, we wanted to do a fully integrated arts program. We quickly realized that that involved a lot more detail than we were A, ready for, and B, had the capacity to create effectively. With the arts enhanced model that we are proposing now, that's something that I've been doing in my classrooms on a single classroom basis for a long time and seen the benefits of that. We also understand that being in a rural community, we've seen that we have a much more limited pool of both students and educators, and so the arts enhanced model will be a lot more feasible to not only hire sufficient educators, but make sure that those educators are adequately trained and feel confident in how they're integrating and enhancing their academics with the arts. We also have done a lot of research, both with Arizona School for the Arts and many other programs, including the Kennedy Center, Arts Institute in Kentucky, and we've seen the benefits of separating a little bit more of the academics from the arts and making sure that the students get a high quality education in both areas to enhance their knowledge and just make sure that they have a deep understanding of all the academic concepts as well as the fundamentals of the arts and the technicalities and the skill sets required on both areas.
So in that transition, it sounds like you looked into research on the benefits and outcomes associated with integration versus enhancement.
Correct.
And so
we've seen that there are actually more benefits with the enhancement than the integration, and part of the reason for that is because there's more curriculum developed for enhancing with arts than there is integrating with arts. There isn't very much, if any, curriculum that yet is widely known and has been used and studied that integrates the arts fully into the academics. Whereas traditional academics with an arts enhancement or additional arts classes, there are plenty of curriculum and that have been proven and studied for many, many years that will be, that are not only effective for our population, but have been effective for many populations. And so we've just found that that separation has proven to be more successful for the students than the fully integrated model.
All three of us learned so much about so many things regarding education as we filled out the application, as we looked at your comments for the first iteration, as we then strove to answer your questions and not recast, but clearly identify what we were really trying to do. But we have learned so much about every peak, every section in this notebook, every section of the application. We are all much more informed about it all than we were 2 years ago.
So sticking with the words, asking about words, the name, Liberty Leadership Academy. If you could talk a little bit how you decided to use leadership and not have any reference to the arts in the name, and how, what the thought process behind that is.
Definitely. Well, start with the first word, Liberty, is actually my middle name, so that's initially where it came from. But in just idea, I like the, we like the idea of liberty being kind of an idea of freedom and opportunity and choices. Leadership, we believe, is very, very important as the arts, because when you develop students to be leaders, they can then, of course, become leaders for our community, which our community, our society, definitely needs more leaders, in our opinion. We need students who can think critically and who not only have those leadership skills, but want to become leaders and want to change our world for the better. So that's where that word came in. And then Academy, we believe we have a high set of standards, as many people do, but it more or less sounded better than Liberty Leadership School or charter. So the word Academy is kind of, I believe that it gives an impression of being one and being kind of unified, as opposed to everybody doing their own thing. And we really want our school to feel like a community and feel welcoming to not only the students and parents who attend, but the rest of the community state-wide.
Have you seen our logo? I know you can't accept new documents, but it's the torch for liberty, and the books for Academy, and the performing arts, and the globe for leadership. That's
so thinking about some of the research, a few of the studies cited seem to focus a little more on the benefits of music when you look at arts enhancement, or look a little bit at the benefits for high school.
Mm-hmm.
What specifically have you guys seen that ties more to dance and some of the areas you're hoping to offer, and more of a focus on the elementary side?
So we've definitely noticed that there is more research based in the music. I think that's partially just due to the fact that there are more music programs. There isn't as much research based in the performing arts aspect because the programs aren't as widely available. However, we have done research a lot with the Kennedy Center and also with the Getty Museum. The Getty Museum focuses a little bit more on the visual arts, but the Kennedy Center has really been a leader in the performing arts aspect of incorporating and enhancing academics with the arts. Our goal our reasoning for including the performing arts is partially due to that lack thereof, not only in our community, but just, I believe, nationwide. But again, mostly on my, that's how I grew up, my education and just my previous outside of school experience. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to go to a school that included performing arts, but I grew up in a dance studio. And very, very quickly, I saw myself, even as a child, but many of my teachers' comments and as I look back have mentioned how I developed skills, including determination and self-motivation, that I learned more in my arts classes, my dance classes specifically, than I did in my academic classes. And so we've really seen that correlation to how the performing arts engage parts of the brain that students aren't typically using, and to enhance their academics. In my own personal classrooms, I've really, because that's what I've always wanted to do, I've incorporated a lot of arts into my lessons and been, I mean, of course, I was excited about doing that, but I've been even more impressed with the amount of growth that I've seen through students who in previous years, you know, kinder, first, second grade, maybe didn't make very much growth for a multitude of reasons. But then when they were introduced to the arts, specifically dance and music, they really made those jumps. And I believe that it's another mode of teaching that really reaches a lot of students that maybe aren't worksheet type students or students who maybe have attention deficit. And, you know, so many of our students these days don't want to sit in a chair and listen. I know I don't like to sit in a chair for a long time. So I've seen so many benefits, not only in my own classroom, but just in with the teachers that I've also co-taught with or just worked next to. You know, I've kind of spread and give them ideas. They've come to me for ideas on, you know, how are you getting these low students to make such progress? And I've really attributed it to the arts because they've done the same thing in their other classes and it hasn't been making progress. So the arts is what's been different in my classrooms. And that's where I believe that the jumps have been made. It gives students a way to learn skills in a different method than reading a book or listening to a lecture. It also gives them a way to demonstrate that they've mastered skills, again, through other, maybe through a song and a dance, maybe through a rhythm, or maybe they write lyrics to a new song. And so it gives them a way to show that they understand the skill, but maybe not on a test with multiple choice questions, because many students have test anxiety and things that they know the skills, but when it comes time to prove them, it doesn't show that they know them because of the way that we're assessing them. And so I found that students are able to open up more and show a deeper knowledge of their skills through the arts than they would on a traditional paper pencil or even an oral presentation.
Okay. Kind of building on that, thank you. I want to ask one more, thinking a little more about socioeconomic diversity.
Okay.
I think you guys are expecting a pretty diverse population at this school. And sometimes some of the studies about music programs show these great results because more affluent schools are more likely to have an excellent music program.
For sure.
And so sometimes it's not exactly a match. What have you guys seen as far as programs like this that are working and impacting student achievement for the target population you're hoping to serve?
Definitely. So I've been, for the last 7 years in Cottonwood, so I've been in this sort of same socioeconomic group. And so I've seen the transitions more so actually with the lower students than with the higher students in our own community. And I think that's due to the fact that the higher students, although they have more opportunities outside of school, they may be able to participate in more clubs or more things, they tend to separate that knowledge. So they do their schooling and then they do their sports or their clubs. Whereas the lower economically disadvantaged students, they don't have those extra opportunities outside of school. And so when they get them in school, they really cling on to them and they really thrive because that's the only place that they're getting them. So there may be quote unquote higher quality outside of the schools, but what they're getting in the schools is so rich to them because it's their only option. And I found also that they are the students that tend to do the best because they don't have, I mean, they go to school and they go home. You know, they may watch TV, but they don't get those culturally rich opportunities that the higher income students might get to go to the theater or go to a sports game or things. And so they really enjoy them and they find, again, just like everybody, they find those ways of expressing themselves that they didn't know that they had before. And they see their own progress. And so when they start making those jumps and they say, oh, you know, okay, maybe I'm struggling with reading, but I can tell you everything that I just saw in this song or that I just learned from this skill, they see their own progress, and then that helps them to make more progress because now they have more self-confidence and now they're able to go home and share that with their family, whereas before, you know, maybe everything was difficult and school wasn't a fun place to be. Now they're enjoying it, and so that helps them learn.
Of course.
I was wondering if you could clarify the recommendation for retention. Is it the parents, the board, or the teachers that make that final decision?
You're talking about student retention and grades?
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, it's a conversation between the team, so we always want to involve not only the teacher and the administration, the curriculum team, but of course the parents, because ultimately they know their child very well, and we want to make sure that we do what's best for the child. So we always aim to come to an agreement that everybody is in agreement with, and we hope that the parents will trust in our knowledge of their child from the school aspect, and also just our knowledge of students and their education in general and what's in their best interests. If we got down to the point where it was just we recommend one thing and the parents disagreed and we couldn't, I don't foresee where we couldn't come to some sort of agreement, but ultimately it would come down to the school making their recommendation as far as what's best for the child, but the parents have the ultimate decision as far as if they're going to retain the student, keep them at our school, transfer schools, as parental rights go. But I truly believe that through conversation and through education, we can come to an agreement that works in first for the student, but also that everybody agrees with because they know it's the best choice for that student.
And now if a teacher says this child needs to be held back and the parent says no, are you going to insist that the child is held back, or are you going to let the parent walk to another school?
Well, again, that would come down to, we would have that conversation, because it wouldn't be up to the teacher and the parent. They wouldn't be the end-all, be-all of that conversation. We would have our administration, myself, involved. We'd also have probably the special ed, if there was issues there, special ed team involved, our MTSS team, our aides. So there would be a lot of input from multiple angles,
mm-hmm.
and I believe that we would come to an agreement that was in the best interest of the child through the discussions and through, okay, this is what we think, this is what, you know, everybody gets their say and their input, but ultimately everybody's going to want to do what's best for the child.
So at the end of the day, everyone at the school has decided the student cannot move on to the next grade level, and the parent says, I want you to move them on. Do you move them?
We would not move them. We would give them that choice to stay at our school and be retained, or of course, being that we are a charter school, they would have the option to move. We wouldn't want to lose them, but again, we want that student to be successful, and if we truly believe that they're not going to be successful in that next grade, we wouldn't want to move them on because the parent decided, because we feel like that's setting them up for failure.
Thank you.
Definitely.
If we could talk a little bit about the promotion criteria. Is the threshold 60% or 70%? What are the requirements for being promoted from?
So from one grade to the next. Promotion will ultimately be based on a multitude of things. It's not ever going to come down to one assessment or one grading period, because no one grade or assessment can demonstrate a child's knowledge. So, of course, we're going to aim for that 70% and higher, as of course, but that 70% is what we believe gives the student enough knowledge to be able to continue building on those skills, but also be successful in deepening their knowledge and moving on to more difficult skills. Now, 60 to 70%, it kind of depends on the assessment. You know, when we're talking about AZ Merit and state assessments, obviously we want them to be proficient. We don't want to move on a student who falls far below or scores in a very low percentile. However, again, we would look, even if a student did score on AZ Merit, for example, in that low percentage, but then they had much different results in their day-to-day classwork and their day-to-day assessments, we're going to take all of their assessments and all of their progress and come to an agreement again, what's best for the student? Where are they demonstrating, at what percentage are they demonstrating the majority of their knowledge? So that we're not basing everything on one benchmark or one even easy merit aims.
So will AZ merit or whatever exam is in place at the time be incorporated into that grade?
Oh, definitely, for sure. So we'll have, we kind of have, I don't want to say algorithm, but AZ merit is part of it. The benchmarks that we do 3 times a year school-wide will be part of that assessment. Their progress monitoring, every student is going to be progress monitored in a multitude of subjects monthly, regardless of what their academic level is, because we want to make sure that not only are the low students progressing, but we also want to make sure that those high students are continuing to progress. So the monthly benchmarks will be part of their ultimate grade. And at the end of the year, we take all of these things into consideration and we look and see, do they have the skills to be successful in the next grade?
And continuing on that thread, so sometimes and more recently, the state assessment scores have been available at the end of the school year.
Correct.
Sometimes they are not. We also have changes in assessment every few years, it seems like. They go out for a new RFP. How have you accounted for those changes or the timing of assessment results and being able to make a decision for students and families on whether or not they've passed and can move on to the next grade level if you're not getting those results in time?
Definitely. I mean, of course, in a perfect world, we would have those results at the end of the year, but as you said, oftentimes we don't. But again, that's only one piece of the puzzle. And through the progress monitoring and through the day-to-day interactions that we have with the student, we believe that not only on the administration level, but the teachers are going to know how that student's doing. So the teachers are going to have a pretty good assessment of how that student is going to perform on the state tests, regardless of when we actually get those scores back. So if, you know, if a student is getting all A's and doing very well, you know, it's highly unlikely that they're going to, that they're going to get their AZ merits back and fall far below. You know, if a student kind of on the opposite end is doing very poorly, then we can make a logical guess that they probably aren't going to do very well on their state assessments either. But again, while we want to include those state assessments, and we will even when they come like they did this year, you know, a couple months into the next year, we're going to have such a wide range of knowledge and wide range of scores for every student that that's just one piece. And it's a great piece to have, but if we don't have it, we have so much other data that's going to tell us how they're doing that we'll have an accurate representation of whether or not to promote them at the end of the school year.
Your application states that the professional development is planned a year in advance. Is there any flexibility to your planning?
Definitely. So we have certain professional development that we will do that is planned so far in advance because it'll happen either yearly, quarterly, monthly. But then we all always have room for professional development based on teacher and school needs because those change minute by minute. And so we have built into our professional development, not only in our teacher schedule, but time to incorporate the needs of the teachers and give us time to find, if we don't already have the professional development scheduled, find professional development to address those specific needs when they're needed. One of the things that we want to make sure of is that not only are teachers able to tell us what they feel they need, but that they get it in a timely manner. So if we have a professional development need that comes up in September, we don't want to wait until April to train on that. We want to train as quickly as possible to help the teachers be as effective as they can. So again, some of that professional development is things that we already know everybody's going to need yearly, quarterly, but then much of the professional development will be needs-based.
And needs-based will be just general conversations, not necessarily a survey.
We also, yes, so we do have general conversations, not only through the observations between the teachers and principal, and just the monthly interactions, but also we have a survey that the teachers and students and parents, one for each, can fill out at any point in the year to express if there's things that they are struggling with or things that they believe the school needs, mostly, you know, on the teacher's end, in the professional development area for themselves, but also in the needs for their students. But then on the student and parent level, we want to make sure that the students and parents are not only part of the school, but feel like the school is improving. So we have a survey for them as well, how to make the school better and things that they, you know, might like to see. They could be training, they could be school improvements, they could be any suggestions really, but those are available every day for students, teachers, and parents.
Thank you.
Or if you see something
definitely
that needs handling school-wide, or even just in a pocket of the school, you would be quick to add that to the professional development schedule.
Right. Definitely.
Shifting now to marketing and enrollment. So thinking about your marketing and enrollment strategy, can you tell us a little bit more about it and how it came about, and what's your evidence that these things you're going to try will result in the enrollment you're hoping to get to?
All right. I did a major part of that. I did a lot of research regarding the schools in the area, which you've seen have taken advice from other people who have been instrumental in charter school setups, successful setups, and made the determinations of what we could expect to see based on the schools. In Cottonwood, also at Verde Valley, we made that basis on families who live within 10 miles of the school and families who live within 20 miles of the school, 20 to 25 miles of school, I think 21 years old. So we based the closer group a little higher. We gave them a little higher percentage point than we did the ones that are a little farther away. And then we also took the estimated homeschooled and online schools and gave them a very low percentage. So we basically went 3%, 2%, 3%. And that 3% was based again on conversations with Hillsdale College, who runs the Barty Charter School group, if you're familiar. Then Rachel, who has lived in Cottonwood for 8 years, taught in Cottonwood for 8 years, runs a dance studio that she has grown from 0 to 100 members in 5 years.
Yeah, three, five years,
something like that. 5 years? No, I think it's 5 years.
We've been open for 6 years, but we reached about 100 students in our mid-third year.
Okay.
So she's got a big following there of exactly who would be applicable students for the school. So there's 100 families there we have. She's also been very active in the community. If you have a chance to read the community partnership pieces, she's been involved in just about everything that's gone on in Cottonwood, and so she's established a huge community from that. She's also a volunteer. She volunteers at her church, which is the Verde Valley Church. It's the largest church in Cottonwood, which is convenient for us. Mm-hmm. And she teaches 2-week summer classes with 500 children, and she, once a month on Sundays, handles the nurseries where she has, again, families that she interacts with. So there's another, you know, 600 families that are ready to be tapped. So those were pretty much what we used to establish enrollment. We also did a lot of research on the development of the area. The area has a 2018 development plan. They've recognized that Cottonwood is growing, will continue to grow. They're trying to make the growth easier and bring in more families with parents. Cottonwood has become a tourist location, a retirement location, so that has spurred a service industry. There's a new medical facility there that covers the entire Verde Valley area. So there's a lot of growth going on there. The plan is also to build about 3,000 new single-family homes over the next 3 years, and many of them will be on the road between Sedona and Cottonwood, which is very helpful because Sedona recently closed a school.
Two schools.
Two schools.
Yeah.
two schools because the parents can't, the workers in Sedona can't afford to live in Sedona. So they kind of drifted down into the Cottonwood area. So all that being said, when you get down to how we got our first 120 enrollment students, it's based on those factors, and it comes to 2.8% of the student population in the schools, which we feel is well worth attaining. We think we can certainly attain that low. We're not going for 5, we're not going for 10 at this point. We're just going for what we think we can reasonably bring into the school. So that's how that came about.
And
I
think a large part of it too is because of my community involvement, word spreads very quickly in small towns, and there's just a very palpable desire for another school. The parents aren't happy with the school choices and the way things are going. Students aren't happy. And in the performing arts aspect from the dance studio, I mean, I just in general conversation, I'm talking to students all the time, and they are always telling me about how, well, I wish we could do this at school, or, you know, my students, who some of them are just school students, some of them also took classes at the studio, have continuously told me how they've used the skills that they learned with me in their previous grades, and the students at the dance studio, you know, have said multiple times, well, why can't you just teach me at school and at dance, and then I don't have to go anywhere else? So I think that there's definitely a need based on all the research, but just a desire for change and a desire for performing arts specifically in our community. There's only two dance studios in the area, mine and one other, and the other one is quite small. There aren't very many opportunities for students to dance, but the desire is definitely growing, not only in my group of students, but just in the areas throughout the community. I work a lot with the director of theater for Mingus Senior High School, which is not the only high school in the area, but it's the high school. And he's been continuously asked, why can't you come teach at the, you know, elementary schools? You have such a great program here at the high school, but we want it for our kids. And so he and I have worked a lot together because he's really excited about our programs, because now he'll essentially get students who are a lot more prepared for his program, which is already successful. But it gives those parents that performing arts aspect that they have wanted. And it's just been, I've been there for 8 years, but the desire has been there since I started. I mean, as soon as I opened the studio, the dance studio, and they found out that I was a teacher, people asked me, you know, can we blend these? Can we hire you to teach our kids? And I teach a lot of homeschool students, and that's another really encouraging aspect, is these students at my dance studio who have been homeschooled their whole life now want to come to school, mostly because they trust in me, but they also, they see the benefits. And so now we have this whole homeschool group that doesn't want to be homeschooled anymore, and they want to participate in the arts and in a more traditional schooling aspect.
To go back to your question, were you also asking what you thought our marketing plan would be?
Well, I think this adds a lot of good additional context. I think some of the things you talked about, I can remember the exact number, maybe hoping
that's
to get 50 students from social media,
mm-hmm.
and that was some of where I was wondering,
I don't know
that social media will pull in 50, or if you guys know more than I do about, you know, your target population. That was... But I think you've
pretty much answered.
You've talked about
it.
It is
a rural community, so every time you walk into a grocery store or a restaurant, you know somebody or somebody knows you. Word of mouth is paramount. I remember early on thinking, well, it would be really great if you could put a billboard on the west side of Cottonwood toward Camp Verde and on the east side of Cottonwood to Sedona. And I thought, oh, we'll just do that. That would be really good. Until I realized that they don't have billboards out there. Well, this is a rural community.
yeah,
who knew? So word of mouth is paramount. The other four board members, in addition to Robin and I, are all born and bred Verde Valley people. They've grown up there. They know people there. So it's going to be, I'm assuming, primarily word of mouth. We will do, we have, as you saw, the other things that we're going to do, we'll hold tons of open houses. We'll invite everybody we know to all of these, and the list will keep growing and growing. We will also send out and canvas neighborhoods with colorful, beautiful postcards that make it look exciting and fun. And so that's, we feel pretty comfortable with those numbers, actually.
The interest is there already, I believe. I mean, we've already built interest lists for both students and teachers and staff before the school has even, you know, been broadcast, really. People are saying, when can I enroll?
And have you had a chance to talk to people? I guess, I'm sorry, you're not going to offer busing to your school?
We're not currently.
Because I think that sometimes in more rural communities can be what you're battling against, is if the local school is willing to send a bus 15 miles to pick them up.
There is that.
How does that work?
But I think you should talk about the other charter school experience with that.
Definitely. So our local schools do bus, and they have a large percentage of students who do ride the bus. But the school that I taught at for 6 years when I first moved to Cottonwood was a school very similar to ours. It was a K, it's a K-12 school, but one class per grade, very small. And the school didn't have a bus until the last 2 years that I was there. And even currently, they have a bus, but it only goes to Camp Verde to pick up students in one location in Camp Verde and then bring them back. And that school has been very successful. It's always had waiting lists, and it's always had full classes, regardless of the comparisons to the public schools. They didn't have a bus. Parents had to drop off and pick up. We noticed that there was a lot of carpooling that happened. A lot of students also stayed for after school activities because of the work schedule of the parents. But we didn't see that the bus route made a difference. The school, it was a small school and they didn't have the desire to expand. But I mean, through K-12, it was full, all the classes, with the exception of a few high school classes. All the elementary school classes always have waiting lists.
That isn't an idea that is final.
So right.
We will considering the idea going forward too. And especially if we're successful in the CSP grant, we might do that. But given the experience of the other charter school, we're just given the fact that that's a huge undertaking to bring a bus on this early, we'd like to see do it without pursuing the goal.
I have a question sort of following up on that. So we've talked a lot about dance and students in the dance studio. We've talked about the theater program at high school. Mm-hmm. The application references music, looking at the enrollment figures, 100 students up to, you know, possibly around 200 students, maybe more than that, a maximum capacity of three at year three. Are students required to be, are all students going to be required to do dance as part of this program? And then do you have enough students to have the resources to offer dance and theater and music?
Definitely. So being that we're a four-day school week, they'll have a different arts class each day, and all students will participate in the arts classes just as they would in the public school. All students go to PE, all students go to visual arts. Same in our school, the arts will just be different. So they'll have dance, and it'll partially depend on our enrollment, I mean, sorry, not our enrollment, partially depend on who we hire in our staffing. We have plans for multiple arts and interest already. I already have staff members ready to start teaching in certain arts, but our plan is that all students will do dance, they'll do a circus art, they'll do music once a week, and then also possibly taekwondo or theater, depending again on who the teachers are that we hire. But all students will participate, and they'll have an arts class, and a specific arts class, every single day for 45 minutes. And as far as, I mean, like traditional schools, every student is required to participate. Not every student loves it, But I believe that the students will be more apt to enjoy these arts classes, not only that they're different, but because it's the whole culture of the school. So even when you're talking about maybe the non-stereotypical boys doing dance, you know, at first, when they come to the school, they might think, oh, I don't like this, I don't want to do that. But when they see their entire school and all of their friends participating, and one of the other great benefits is that we have a male dance teacher who has agreed to teach with us, I think that's going to be exciting for the boys because they're going to see this cool guy doing something that they maybe may or may not have thought that they couldn't do before. And then on the flip side, martial arts tends to be more of a male-dominated sport, although it is growing. We have a fantastic martial arts teacher who is a woman, and a bunch of students, there's a very successful martial arts studio or dojo in the area, and so that's growing. And so I think the girls will be really excited that they get to learn how to, you know, use nunchucks and swords. And so I think that just being that it's part of the culture and everybody does it, that the students will not only enjoy it, but really see that, wow, this is something that I never thought I would do or might like. But yeah, they'll all participate in all these different academic or sports and arts every day.
Don't you want to come?
So this is just probably a quick question on in the business plan, again, in marketing and enrollment. It looked like on page 8 of the enrollment projection, second grade enrollment was projected to drop from year 1 to year 2.
Oh, that's your question.
So when
we've been asked this before.
Well, it's coming. So when you look at the enrollment projections and you're looking straight across the line, year 1 second grade has 30, year 2 second grade has 20. But it's not an actual drop because you have to remember that the year 1 second graders are now third graders in year 2. So that quote unquote drop in the second year is the 21st graders from year 1 become the 22nd graders of year 2. So there's actually no drop, there's just a steady increase each year. Some grades we project will increase quicker than others. And so that's why kindergarten and first grade, we kept at 20 for the first 2 years with no increase, but we think that the second and third graders will be a higher enrollment. So we start at 30 and then let them increase as they go down to the fourth and fifth grades.
Why do you think second, third, and even fourth has a higher capacity? Why do you think that enrollment in those grades where you're asking students to transition from one school to another would be higher than your first time entering kindergarten first?
Partially for two reasons. One, a lot of times when students start in kindergarten, many times they start in their local school. Whatever school is closest to their house is where they start. And so it takes a year or two for that, for not only the students, but mainly the parents to see if they like that school and if it's working for their student. So I found that at the second grade level and sometimes the third grade level, that's typically when the students are really starting to get established and know what's working for them. Does this school routine or this teacher or this program, is it helping me be successful? And so I've found that that's where the most turnaround is between students, parents changing schools, but also on the student aspect, when they get to that second or third grade time, they're more vocal. And so that's when they start to let their parents know more so what's going on at school and whether or not they like it. And it could be for different reasons that they like the school or not. But I've just found through personal experience that there's a lot of transition during that second, third grade time. The fourth and fifth grades, the reason that we have those so low is because our current plan is to only go K-5 as we start. And so we project that the fourth and fifth grade classes for the first couple of years are going to be low because they'll only be able to be at the school for a year or two. And then as the school grows and as they see that the programs are successful, then those younger students who started with us in kindergarten first and second will then stay through fourth and fifth grade because they've been there.
On the prior knowledge, of when you do your education lesson plans and such, frequently you missed, for prior knowledge, the standard of the previous year. So can you explain to me the difference between a second grade writer who can construct a paragraph and a third grade writer who can construct a paragraph?
Based on the prior knowledge?
Just if you, if, just what is the difference between the two levels?
For sure. So definitely, so if we're talking, so there's the standards, of course, and then there's what is, I would consider commonly seen. And the difference between those two, in my opinion, is many students struggle with writing currently. So a second grade writer is expected to write a paragraph with a topic sentence and a conclusion sentence. I found that the majority of second graders are not able to do that at the level that they're supposed to do it by the end of the year. Second graders typically, they can write sentences. They're oftentimes complete sentences, but very basic. Grammar is kind of hit or miss. Topic sentences are usually based on a sentence framework or a starter that a teacher might assign. The higher students might be able to generate their own topic sentences, but typically they need that sentence framework. Whereas a third grade writer is going to have more knowledge. They're going to be able to generate those topic sentences from memory and need less framework or less guidance from their teacher. They're also going to have, of course, better grammar and more detailed sentences, so their sentence fluency will be better. They will include more, more parts of speech, more adjectives, more nouns. Their paragraphs will usually have a conclusion sentence. I've seen typically, because I taught third grade, a lot of times the conclusion sentence is more difficult for the third graders than the topic sentence, so they usually need a sentence starter or a framework, but they're able to expand on that a lot more than a second grader.
So your prior knowledge then would include things like grammar?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, grammar, sentence fluency, sentence structure, paragraph structure.
You understand that. I did not see that in the application, but I see you understand that.
In looking at this part in particular, you have to think about it as if you were handing it off to somebody and weren't giving them the explanation, would the teacher know what the prior knowledge was that was required?
Definitely. And I think on that note, it's so much harder to put it in a bullet list or in a little box that this is what the students need to know. But I mean, for any skill, there's definite prior knowledge, and it builds, of course, each year, deepening, you know, from second to third grade. So you still have your second grade standard. You're going to build on that. You're going to go deeper in the context, but then also to a higher skill level.
Thank you.
Of course.
Switching over to lunch service. When you, have you talked with a vendor, and do you anticipate any additional charges or costs that you would use a plan for as part of providing lunch at your school?
Definitely. So we kind of, like the transportation issue, we have two sort of plans, partially based on that charter school that I worked at before. We would like to have a lunch service because we know that a majority of our population does qualify not only for the free and reduced lunch, but also uses it. When we looked at the public schools, there's a high percentage of students, even students who didn't qualify, who still use the program. So we would like to provide lunch. We've talked to a couple of different vendors and found that their prices are very reasonable. They are oftentimes lower than what the students would pay based on the National School Lunch Program. And they either include delivery fees in those, because a lot of them are based down in Phoenix, but they're very reasonable. The additional costs that we will incur, of course, include, you know, microwaves and ovens and refrigerators, but we're not, at least at the initial startup, we're not going to have a full kitchen, so we're going to do a serve-based lunch versus the prepared lunch that the public schools do.
So because there's not money currently allocated to school lunch, and so that's why I'm wondering, like, even if they were going to deliver and serve lunch, sometimes you need to have a cooler on campus or a food warmer on campus or some of those kinds of things.
Yes.
And then is the vendor going to provide those, or do you maybe need to anticipate?
So we have
as a cost, yeah.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So we have incorporated those costs into our, you'll be able to answer better, into our budgets. They're just not listed as school costs.
More as part of just the build-up budgets.
Mm-hmm. The build-up.
As opposed to the maintenance and operations of
getting
the daily lunches.
Okay.
Yeah, so we've already included refrigerators, microwaves, ovens, all those things that after talking to the vendors, what we would need. So we've included those in our budget, just not in the lunch budget because they're part of the build up for the school.
Yeah. I think the lunch budget is $500, isn't it, or something?
Yeah,
which
like
is
that.
Just for students who don't pay their own bills.
And that's based, and that's based on after talking to the vendors, the cost that the students pay or that don't qualify is going to cover the lunches that aren't covered by National School Lunch Program.
Okay. And the vendors you've talked to, have they talked about handling that paperwork?
Definitely.
For you? Okay.
Yeah. So there's a few little things that we have to do just to, of course, establish contracts and things like that. But they're mostly going to handle the majority of that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's hard in a small community, but we're making it work.
Mm-hmm. So along similar lines, what about your printing costs and copier maintenance? Have they been incorporated? If you're not purchasing books, and which just from experience here, know that the cost to print when you're and make copies when you're not going to be purchasing books for the entire like can be significant. And copier maintenance is always worse than what you would anticipate. So how are those costs accounted for?
So a lot of our books and our curriculum is part of the curriculum budget. So we have incorporated it into the budget. Students will be, for depending on the subject, students will be getting workbooks and printed materials, but they'll be purchased within that curriculum budget. Of course, we will be printing, and we have a we haven't signed the contract yet, but we have vendors prepared to maintain our copiers and make sure that if one goes out, we get another one or get it repaired right away. And all of those costs have been included in the budget. So I feel like we actually were overestimating kind of our paper budget because we know that things can add up very quickly and teachers like to make copies.
I'm curious, since you do have the dance studio, and is there any overlap? Have you considered any conflict of interest? Can the school be viewed as possibly driving more business to the private school? Or will the private school be using any of the school facilities? How is that relationship going to continue?
I can answer that. In anticipation of the charter school, Rachel did not renew her lease for her dance academy this last June. She is still teaching some classes, but she's using temporary space out of a community center. So understanding that her focus is going to be on the charter school, the dance studio will not be part of it at all. The only reason it might come to be in use is if somebody else is in charge of the dance studio, and may want to lease space in the after hours. And if, for example, we need space leased in the after hours, like for example, I did a budget for 60%. If we have already committed to a school that will serve 120 people and we only have students and we only have 60, then we have sort of tapped an existing dance studio in preschool to maybe come in and use facilities that either aren't being used or after hours just to help support the cost. But her interest in the dance studio will not be active any longer.
You won't be teaching?
No.
At school, well.
Right. No.
Excuse me, yes, you won't be teaching dance.
But the dance studio, I think, will definitely...
Continue.
It'll continue, but it will continue under different leadership, and then those students will essentially, ideally, feed into the school.
That's an interesting question. I have a dance studio in Phoenix, and ASA is close by. We actually get a lot of ASA kids at our dance studio. You would think that our kids would go off to the school, but I think it's one of those things like when Postino sets up 4 restaurants on a block, they all get used because there's just more awareness of it. So we have probably benefited from ASA, our private studio in Phoenix, instead of the other way around. First, I was a little irritated, but
I don't have a dance studio.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about your experience or anyone on the team's experience in administration or leadership of the school, thinking about what it looks like, especially for first-year charters, the compliance, not only with the charter board, but the Department of Ed, federal requirements. It's a lot, so if you could talk about maybe your experience, your capacity to fulfill those obligations, or the capacity of your team.
Definitely. So I have not been in a quote-unquote administration role currently. I've been a teacher for many years, and I've been in a lead teacher position, but I believe that my experience comes not only from the teaching aspect and from many of my fellow teachers coming to me for advice and for things that I felt glad to answer for them and help with them, but things that they typically would have gone to an administrator for. And for various reasons, they trusted me and they wanted to come to me, so I believe that that's really helped. But also from running the dance studio for many years, I believe that gives me kind of more of the business aspect, because a school needs, of course, the educational background, but it also needs business, because ultimately you can have a great staff, but if they don't know how to maintain a budget, then the school isn't going to be successful. So I believe that my experience running the dance studio is very similar. Scheduling, hiring teachers, maintaining quotas of students and enrollment, planning productions, also maintaining that retention of both the students and the teachers at the dance studio, following budgets, making sure that we have what we need when we need it. So I think that my experience between teaching and running the studio will be very adequate and complementary to each other to run a school.
If I can add something to that, we're already working with Aspire Business Consultants, just in some of the preliminary things that we've done. And we're going to, I think, probably rely on them quite a bit, at least in the first year, for establishment of a lot of the items that we need to be in compliance with, so that we kind of know where we're going, how we're going to do it. They've got the expertise in it, and that will help. In addition, Rachel mentioned her LPA. I will also mention that I've been with the state of Arizona for a long time, particularly in the budget area, and I'm planning on being a long-time volunteer, I guess, is the word for that. So I think I can be very helpful in doing that. I'm already doing the filings, I'm already doing the taxes, I'm already doing those kinds of things. So when we start to put all of those in, and we're hiring a business administrator, thank you, Rachel, in the first year. So depending on the experience of that business administrator, will also depend on how much we might use Aspire or a company like that. So I think we have enough pieces that if we put them all together, it will take care of most of those matters. Something will pop up, I'm sure.
And may I add one more thing? One further level up, Rachel has already made contact with a retiring school administrator who wants to be on our board. Obviously, we can't change our board until and if we're granted the charter. But this person is ready, willing, and eager
to be
on our board as a retiring school administrator. So that will provide some experience and wisdom at the board level too. So.
Will this be then, this is going to be a working board or a governing board?
Well, we're hoping for a little of both. I've served on both kinds. And we're hoping to encourage as much volunteer work from the board as we can. But it's also not a salary board, so we'll see where it goes. We'll see where it goes.
We've got some pretty committed people right now. We've got people who serve on other boards who are committed to helping the community, so they're not just picked out of the street kind of. They've been selected.
And also people in the business, just in the volunteer realm, who have already expressed and already not only expressed interest in helping, but have started to help us with the business aspects of the school and separately the educational aspects of the school. So some previous administrators and current administrators have been working with me a lot on how, what needs to happen and just guiding advice.
Just have one more question. I know we're getting close on time, but it's very clear your passion about the arts and dance, and in talking about the program of instruction, what the offerings look like, and the reliance on available teachers that have expertise in those areas. In a rural community, it sounds like you know, someone else who is interested in doing this art, visual arts program, or the things you mentioned. Do you feel that your program is vulnerable to, you know, just the lack of people around? Like, are you going to have trouble recruiting teachers because it's rural and there aren't very many people, and you're looking for some of these like highly specialized areas? And are you relying too much on like you as the person who has been involved in dance for several years as a dance teacher?
Yeah. I don't believe so. I know that there is a teacher shortage in Arizona. However, I already have, I would say, over half of the needed staff, quote unquote staffed, through teachers that I've either worked with or teachers that have worked with people that I know who are passionate about these things that I'm passionate about. They have not grown, many of them have not grown up in the performing arts world, so speaking on the academic aspect, but they've seen what I do in the classroom and also what I've done as far as adding the performing arts to the school. At the previous school that I worked at, myself and one other teacher, we created school-wide performances that included the performing arts, and so some of these teachers that are planning to come work for us have seen the benefits of that, and that, you know, they, a lot of times that's what they're coming to me and asking, well, how did you teach fractions with, you know, fractions with dance, or how did you teach the kids about the Civil War, you know, in theater? And so even though the community is smaller, the teachers that have expressed interest in working with us are passionate about the performing arts. And we'll provide, of course, that professional development for them because they don't have that past experience. But because they already want to do that and they want to incorporate it, I believe that the professional development and their desire is going to prove to be very effective. And then on the performing arts aspect, again, that requires a lot more development in teachers with previous experience. But again, because our community is so limited, we do have those teachers currently, but then we also expect to draw from the surrounding communities. Sedona is a very artistic community, and so we believe that there are, and I've talked to many people who have those talents, but they just didn't have a place to teach them. So I don't foresee that being a problem.
We have a connection with the NAU Preparatory Dance School up there. This is a long-time connection through our studios of the gentleman that Rachel said would want to teach. And he's a highly rated teacher internationally. So he's willing to come in and help. He's excited about coming in to help. Yes, that's true. She's got a great relationship with the Smart Martial Arts facility in Cottonwood that she's used in production, actually, which has been really nice, and they're excited. And Rachel has already, having had a dance studio now for 5 years, been training teachers all along in that dance studio, so she already has a start with a lot of these performing arts side of the teachers, in addition to the academic teachers that she's worked with.
So some of the dance, the teachers that currently were teaching dance at my studio will teach the arts for the school.
Well, and one of the board members has got master's degree in fine arts as a concert pianist and a teacher, and another board member has started a dance sport team in the previous school that Rachel was in Muse Arts. So I think we have a lot of resources available to us right now, just starting out, but we'll be fine.
And to start with a high quality too.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to start with high
schoolers
kids teaching classes after they've taken for 2 years. I mean, we have high quality teachers, both in the academics and in the arts.
And we also have a great relationship with the Sedona Ballet.
Sedona Chamber Ballet.
Sedona Chamber Ballet. Another woman who's interested in being part of the board potentially. So.
Well, I think teachers talk to teachers. I think as soon as we get the school going and the teachers talk to their teacher friends nearby and even far away, I wouldn't be surprised if we have teachers who contact Rachel and say, hey, I'd love to move to Sedona and teach this, that, and the other. Because just like all of us, teachers talk to teachers. So.
And there aren't, one of the other, I believe, benefits is that there isn't another arts, performing arts school, basically north of Phoenix. I mean, once you get out of the Phoenix metropolitan area, the next performing arts opportunity that you have within a school realm is all the way up in Flagstaff, and that's not until fourth grade. So the desire is there, but also it brings, because that need is there, and you can't go to Prescott, you can't go anywhere else. So there's these teachers and these people who have these talents who want to maybe not move down to Phoenix or move up to Flagstaff, who've already contacted me and said, okay, when is your school opening? Because I want to come teach or help her. You know, what can I do? So we have a lot of artists in our community.
In the community, there's, and we're planning on trying to tap the retirement segment also, since a lot of the arts programs can be part-time programs.
For volunteers.
For volunteers, yeah.
Now we give you 5 minutes to make a closing statement to the panel. Board staff will cue you, as we did with the opening statement, when you have 1 minute remaining and when the 5 minutes is complete.
Well, of course, we want to just thank you for taking our application into consideration. We feel that this is going to be a very positive change and positive choice for the students of our community. We believe that it's going to help increase their academic potential and ultimately their academic achievement by giving them opportunities that they currently don't have through the performing arts. And we have, through all of our research, found that the desire is there, the need is there, and the benefits just so outweigh the negatives of including the performing arts, that we want to give the students that chance to be successful and use those skills that they acquire through enhancing their academics with the performing arts to not only increase their test scores and their academic achievement, but help them to become future leaders of the community, state, and nationally, and just be successful in whatever choices that they make in their adult lives. And we just hope that this choice will be offered to those students.
Do you have anything to say?
Thank you very much, all of you, for doing this. We've spent 2 years now on this, and we've learned a lot. Coming from highway patrol to education is a big switch for me, but the reports are the same, though, I have to say. You know, the numbers are about the same. I've really enjoyed this, and the passion has grown, and I've spent a lot of time there researching that whole Verde Valley area, and it just seems to be right for an opportunity like this.
We've been so excited this week that this day is finally here. We finally get to come and talk about our dream, our vision, our passion, and we are thrilled that we got the opportunity to come and talk to you today. None of us have ever run a school before, but we come from educational and experiential backgrounds that make it really possible that we can do this, and we very much hope that you give us the opportunity. Thanks so much.
Thank you. To conclude the in-person interview, I will describe the next steps. The technical review panel will evaluate the scores from the review of your written application package as well as the findings of the interview panel. This will include whether your written application package met the scoring criteria specified in the application and whether the interview panel finds sufficient capacity to operate a charter school. Next, a recommendation report will be submitted to board staff and will be presented to the board at the December 9th meeting. This will be a full day that will begin at 9 a.m. We anticipate that this will be a long meeting, so plan for the possibility of your application being considered on the following day, December 10th, if the meeting runs long. If you have any questions about the next steps, you can contact Rachel Hanna. You have a copy of her card and her information. And once again, the Arizona State Board of Charter Schools, the technical review panel, and board staff would like to thank you for coming here today and for your interest in providing quality educational choices to the children of Arizona.
Thank you.